Okay, very warm welcome to everyone who is with us in person and everyone listening some later time. Welcome to the Peace Alliance Action Call for the month of January 2021. I'm Dan Kahn, National Field Coordinator for the Peace Alliance, and I deeply appreciate y'all being with us this evening. This is a wild time. I mean, I guess it kind of always is, but I just sort of want to ask, how's everybody doing? Let's take a breath. Just recognize that I think there are some pretty intense challenges all over. Like, just editorializing a little bit, when there is a movement of force against the capital of the country, when legislators are hiding and huddling together, and things are getting broken in the aftermath of an election, I think it can shake us in a particular way. I think that the fact of our democracy, with all its flaws and all its room for improvement, the fact that we to some degree trust in this electoral process and say, this is how we're gonna do things, and then different stories about who won the election and how legitimate the results were and what things mean, different stories coming into conflict, and the regardless of what the courts say, and regardless of what a lot of us may think, many people are willing to continue believing that this election was stolen and that there's a need for this kind of action. I think it is disturbing for a lot of us. So I think a time of warm tea for me, a time of fuzzy clothing, getting enough sleep if we can, and going with what works. So I'm glad that in the midst of all this, you've decided to come together with us as this community, the Peace Alliance. In a moment, I'm going to introduce our special guest for the evening. And then after we hear from our special guest, Jo Berry, and have a chance for discussion and question and answer with her, then we'll hear an update from Kendra Mann of the Department of Peace Committee. And then we'll hear a small update from the Truth and Reconciliation, Truth and Healing Working Group activities. And then we'll have a chance for shares from the field. So we should have plenty of time, I think, to hear what's going on with all of you folks who might wish to share what's happening in your organizing, in your neighborhoods, in your schools, in your activism, et cetera. So that is the plan for this evening. Welcome. Let me tell you a little bit about Jo Berry. And usually I would not read all the way through a bio. I would sort of pick a couple of you know, snippets and highlights, but I found reading through Jo's bio to be very kind of nourishing and like inspiring and comforting for me. So I'm actually going to read it pretty much start to finish, and I hope it has the same effect on you all. Jo Berry is an inspiring speaker who works to resolve conflict around the world. 16 years after her father was killed by an IRA bomb, Jo first met with the man responsible, Pat McGee. This initial three-hour meeting led to them speaking on over 300 occasions on a shared platform around the world. Their unusual relationship has been told in the BBC documentary, Facing the Enemy, was featured in the film Beyond Right and Wrong, and inspired The Bomb, a play by Kevin Dyer. Just gonna let in the person that's waiting in the waiting room. Jo is the founder of the charity Building Bridges for Peace and advocates that unbounded empathy is the biggest weapon we have to end conflict. With political, religious, and racial divides deepening as global and local events unfold, her words offer a message of hope and encourage us all to see the humanity in others. Jo is frequently invited to address international conferences and seminars on themes of humanitarian aid, conflict resolution, and human rights. She has worked in areas of conflict, including Lebanon and Rwanda, India, Ireland, Palestine, and Israel, as well as throughout the UK. She has spoken in venues throughout this country. This is this country. I wonder if that means England or the US. Probably both, maybe. Both, yeah. And joined panels and discussion forums on radio and TV. Over the last years, Joe has developed workshops in schools and with youth groups on topics of conflict transformation, storytelling, becoming positive change makers, and challenging violent extremism. She's a TEDx speaker and a visiting fellow with the University of Nottingham. Her research primary area is in rights and justice. Joe is also trained as a restorative justice facilitator and is an advocate for restorative justice. Currently, she is busy writing a book, but she managed to find time to be with us this evening, and we're so grateful. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you. It's an honor to be with you all, and that was an amazing introduction. So I'm going to spend about 10 minutes sharing some of my story and then open it up for questions. So back in 1984, when my father was killed, I was already someone who was thinking about peace. But to me, peace was about meditation. It was like being away from the challenges of the world. But the moment the bomb went off, I felt I was now part of a war. I was part of a violent conflict, and I couldn't go back to the person I had been. It took about 8 hours before they found my dad's body. And the first thing I had to do was tell my little brother and sister what had happened. And with all the trauma and shock, I made a decision 2 days later. I'm going to bring something positive out of this. I'm going to try and understand those who killed my father. I don't want an enemy. And I was just 27 and didn't even know how to grieve. I didn't know how to feel. I used to meditate to feel, and that didn't work anymore. But a journey started. It was a journey where I chose to not blame, not go for revenge, but instead try to understand. And at that time, it was very difficult to find out anything about the IRA, who they were the ones who said they were responsible. So I went to Ireland to try and get some answers. I met people who shared their stories with me. But it was only with the peace process that my life changed. Because until the peace process, there were bombs going off all the time. There were people being killed in London, where I was living, as well as in Northern Ireland. And every time it happened, I cried and I wanted to be there to stop it all and didn't know how. But with the peace process, I found a way into the healing and reconciliation. For the first time, there were programs I could go to where people had been affected by the violence could share their stories together. And that was the year 2000, where I met lots of people who, like me, had been bereaved, people from different sides. And I also met men who'd been in the IRA, ex-IRA prisoners, who shared with me what it was like for them to be in prison and now to be free. And many of them knew Patrick McGee, and he was also released from prison as part of the peace process. So I knew that he'd left the IRA. I knew he was committed to the peace process. So I decided to meet him. It took a long time. People kept on telling me he didn't want to meet me, people who said they'd organize it, but I persevered. It's like I was compelled. I needed to sit down with him, not to change him, not to get his words on forgiveness, but to see him as a human being, to look into his eyes and see some humanity. I wanted to hear his story. And one day I got a phone call to say that he'd agreed to meet me that evening. And I remember feeling terrified. Was this the right day? How could I do it? And I got a ferry from Wales to Ireland across the Irish Sea, so scared, on my own. Those of you that know anything about restorative justice knows that I broke every rule. I'm on my own. There's no one there, no preparation. And I arrive in this house. It's not a prepared environment. It's just a friend's house in a suburb of Dublin, knowing the next person who's going to come in the door would be Patrick McGee. I remember him walking in, and I got up from the table, and I shook his hand and said, "Thank you for coming." And he said, "Oh no, thank you for inviting me. We were very polite." And he spoke very softly, and he looked like he was extremely worried. And we went into our own room, and he started off in a very quiet voice saying, I had to do this. And he gave me the reasons why he joined the IRA. They were the oppressed. They had no other way. He saw suffering in his community. And I was familiar with that. I knew from the other people I'd met in the IRA that he would come with a sense of righteousness. My dad was the had the power. He'd been a member of parliament. And in Patrick McGee's perspective, they'd abused the power. And Patrick McGee represented those that had no voice. And he thought he had righteousness on his side. But I remember looking at his eyes and seeing how much he cared for his community, and actually what a hard decision it was for him to use violence. It took him many months of struggle. And I could see him as a human being. There was a human now to the appalling labels he had been given, because at that time he was the most demonized terrorist we had. Obviously since then they've been replaced by many, many others, but he'd almost killed the British government. And I remember thinking, I've got what I want. I can see his humanity, but I'm going to go now, because he's justifying killing my father. And that's difficult to hear. Nobody need ever know I've done this. I hadn't told anyone I was going, but this is enough. And I'm going to go now. And I need never see him again. But something has been healed in me. I've got something back, which the bomb took away. And at that moment, he stopped talking and he rubbed his eye and he said, I don't know anymore who I am. Can I hear your anger? Can I hear your pain? What can I do for you? And I knew in that moment he'd taken off his political hat. And he'd opened up and become vulnerable, and his heart had been opened. And what had been just my need to meet him now became his need to meet me. And he changed. His voice changed, the tone changed. He stopped saying we and started saying I. He wanted to know the kind of man my dad had been. He wanted to know the impact on my life of losing my dad. He wanted to hear how much it had hurt me. And as we spoke for another hour and a half, I realized it was another journey starting. And it was a journey we were both committed to. And Patrick began to see my dad as a human being, because when he planted that bomb, and this is true for all violence, he didn't see a human being in that hotel. One of my daughters, when she was seven, a few months later, gave him a message. Ask Patrick McGee, did he not see my granddad Tony in the hotel? And I remember Patrick McGee saying, no, I saw no one. And after another hour, I couldn't listen anymore. I'd reached my limit. I had parts of me that were thinking, what am I doing here? I was listening to myself at the same time as I was listening to Patrick. And so I said, I'm going to go now, thank you. And he said, I'm really sorry I killed your dad. No, I didn't go for that apology, but what I got from that was he was now seeing my dad as a human being. And I remember leaving that meeting feeling the intensity of what had just happened and knowing it wasn't finished. The next week, I went through feelings of betrayal. I doubted myself, but I was compelled to go back for a second meeting and a third meeting. And he felt the same. For him, it was something he had to go back and do some more work. And he came back and we carried on talking. And sometimes we talked for hours and hours and hours. And someone came to film some of the meetings, and that became part of the documentary. And a year later, we went public, which was another big, big challenge. Because whilst I was just doing it for myself, it was easier. But telling family members, there were five people killed, telling all those families. For him, telling other people who'd been in, he called them his comrades, who'd been in the IRA. It was very, very hard for both of us to go public. And I went public because I thought, if one person will see the documentary and from the documentary choose to not use violence, then it's worth it. It's worth the fact that my family might be affected by this. And then after that, we had our first talk. And that was the time when Patrick said, I now know I could have a cup of tea with Joe's dad. And I can see the two of them together having a cup of tea. And how much better would it have been if they could have had that cup of tea, because that's about respect and dignity and listening. But the Conservative government didn't have a policy of cups of tea. They still don't. That is about the work that we're all trying to do, because that's about dialogue and listening and prioritising those conversations, those difficult conversations. So it's now been 20 years since I first met him. We are in touch. He has become my friend. At the moment, there are some challenges. It's been a transformative dialogue relationship. I care about him. I've been to places where he's the only person I know. I've changed the story. He's not just the man who's planted the bomb which killed my dad. He's the man who's traveled with me in different places, who's given me support, who's listened to me. So I've changed the story. For me, it's about unbounded empathy. For the empathy is that if I'd lived his life, would I have made the same choices as him? And I don't know. And I've had that experience with all different sides of the conflict in Northern Ireland. And there's three sides. There's the British Army, British government, there's the Catholic, and then there's the Protestant. And I've met with ex-soldiers, ex-lawless combatants, ex-IRA combatants, and know that I could have been each of them. I could have been their sister, their mothers, their daughters. And that shows me that there are no sides. There are just people whose stories we haven't heard, but there are no sides. But there's only one thing that stops me from seeing the humanity in everyone and stops me from really knowing there are no sides, and that's my own. Still, I have a need sometimes to blame and judge people. I can't always open my heart, but that is the daily work that I do. So I shall end by saying, I never wanted my father to be killed, obviously, but I'm grateful for what I've been learning through transforming that pain into working for peace, into my compassion that I have for humanity, and for the extremely transformative dialogue I've had with Patrick McGee. When I think back to 27-year-old me who wanted to make something positive out of it, you know, he's actually helped me to do this. So I'm now going to open this up, because there's a lot more I can say, but I think it'd be much better as interaction and your questions and comments.
Thank you so much for that, Joe. I just invite folks to take a moment and just really breathe in what was just shared. So everyone has a slightly different device software, et cetera. You can join the conversation by raising your hand. You can either, if you can find a hand raise button on your computer, you can raise that hand, or you can raise your physical hand to get my attention. If you're on your phone, *9 should create the raising of a hand. Any reactions, questions, Nancy? Right.
Yeah. Thank you, Joe. I every time I hear your story, I'm just even more touched. I guess I would ask, how would you apply, or what kind of advice or guidance would you give us in this country, seeing what we're going through right now? I mean, I know we're not unique in the world, but what your advice would be, and how maybe your corner of the world is seeing this country.
Oh, thank you, Nancy. I mean, we're having a lot of problems here as well, with divisions. But yes, we are looking at and seeing what's happening in your country. And I was thinking the other day, I was taking part in a discussion that, you know, in Rwanda after the genocide, they had the Gacaca courts, which happened all through Rwanda. The prison system was overloaded. They couldn't use the prison system. So they used their own restorative justice system, the Gachacha courts, and they weren't perfect. But what it was just all the little villages, they had like these fires and people would sit round and they'd have discussions and they'd bring together the perpetrators and the victims. But I love the idea of just little conversations everywhere where people can share. So people from who have different opinions can listen to each other with that emotional safety. Little groups all over where people can come together who voted differently, who different races, different perspectives, and can just understand that we're all human beings. And I think that's so healing to have safe spaces to share. But then there's also like the injustice and the inequality, and which is obviously also a huge, huge subject. But I do believe that when people are listened to, it allows them to settle their emotions and then maybe look at how they can convert their emotions into doing something positive. But the amount of healing that needs to happen in my country and in your country right now is huge, and it's going to require, just think, listening is what I'd like to offer. It's obviously a multi-pronged, multi-dimensional, like what's needed. So that's just like one aspect.
Yeah, thank you. Just one other quick follow-up. Is there, if people wanted to go deeper on this, do you have any kind of workshops or webinars or anything like that?
Yes, I'm doing some workshops, and to go to my, I've got a new website. I put one workshop up, which is still the UK time, but I'm going to be doing some for USA time. And that's joe-berry.com. So contact me, or contact me at Building Bridges for Peace. But the workshops will be on the joe-berry.com, or write to me there. Because I am now doing workshops online. I've actually been doing some pop-up, I'm calling them caring Zoom spaces. I did one the other day and I had someone from America come, and it was 3:30 in the morning. But it was just a space just to say to people, it's there. So I want just for people to check how they are. We all need space just to be heard. And so I'll be doing more of them. So either check out my Facebook or my website. And the workshops will be going a lot deeper into this, definitely. Thank you.
I saw that both Kendra and Richard had their hands up. Shall we have Kendra, then Richard?
Well, I was just wondering, Joe, you talked about the peace process in England and the UK. Could describe
the peace process. So it was a couple of years where people came together from America, they came all over Europe, from the Republic of Ireland, and they went to Belfast and they all sat down and worked out the peace process. So it was a massive thing. It was like 98-99, and there were the people who were using violence on both sides, the IRA and the UDA, which are like the loyalists, they all agreed to put their arms down. And one of the stipulations was the prisoners were all released from prison. And it was a really big time. And there was a lot of money put into the healing and reconciliation programs in Northern Ireland. It all came from Europe. So yeah, incredible. I mean, there's lots of books written. It's a huge subject, lots of books written about it. I'm not so clued up on all the political aspects of it, but it's an extraordinary success.
Thanks. Richard, did you have something on your mind?
Joe, thank you for sharing your story. I understand that you have been involved in other peace processes in other countries. Is that correct?
And not in the peace processes. I've been there to support the reconciliation, the healing, the moving on. So I take what my experience and share it. And I found that when I go to different conflicts, the conflict I'm in can see there what's happening with them reflected back in a different way. Mm. And the hardest place for me to go is Northern Ireland, because I'm such a trigger there. Even now, I've had a riot. I've had all sorts of challenges there. It's the hardest place. But if I go to Palestine, you know, it's different issues. And so I can create it helps create a new conversation.
So what have you observed how you get people who might be rigid in their beliefs into the same room?
Well, that is the hardest question. So right now I'm trying to get in my country, some of the far right into the room to have a conversation with those that they would deem less than, that they demonize. Mm-hmm. And it's very hard. You know, it's really, really hard, because they feel they're okay. They, you know, they've got no reason. I work a lot with Muslim community, and they're very open, because they know it's going to help them, and they feel the pain. At the moment, the far right have no interest. So I'm trying to find a few gatekeepers. So we have some people, and I know you had them in the States as well, who what we call formers. So they were in the group, but they've left. Mm. And there, I think, would be the great gatekeepers. But that, you know, that's the hardest thing is, you know, this, you can't force any of this. This is all about, you know, people change because they feel it, because they want to. We can't force any of this. So what is the need they'll be meeting if we bring them into the room? So, but I do believe that in preparation, there's so much as possible. We have to have hope about this.
Thank you.
Thanks. Does someone else have a question or reaction that they would like to share? I can't see everyone on my screen right now. So looking to see if there's anybody I'm missing. Yes, Kathleen, sure, go ahead. You're muted right now. There you go.
Yes, I was wondering that early moment before you met him, when you made the decision that you didn't want to go to ask for an apology, that you wanted to go to understand him as a human. I think that's an amazing precursor. Can you tell us how that came about?
I think because it was my experience of meeting other men in the IRA. And I remember asking one of the first men I ever met, do you ever think about your victims? And he looked at me as if I was completely crazy. Why would I think about my victims? And I could see that was the wrong question to ask. I learned quickly. And that his head had never, ever had the thought, because he cut that part of him off so much. So I sort of see that as my research. And I knew that the chance of Patrick McGee ever thinking about my father or the others he killed was zero. And that he would be very much coming from a political righteousness. So I wanted to manage my expectations. So they were very low. You know, I hoped he'd turn up, and I just hope he would share some of his story. And other than that, I did not have many expectations, or I wouldn't have gone if I'd invested too much in that meeting. So I think it was almost like I facilitated myself. And looking back on it, I sort of knew how to meet my needs in the best way that I could. Does that make sense?
It does. It still seems to me to take a huge amount of reflection to be able to know that to get to your goal, you had to release it, sort of.
Yeah. Well, you're right. And that's why I did meet a mediator who said he'd organize it. And then he told me that Patrick McGee didn't want to meet me, which was never true. But I think it was other people never thought it should happen because it would be too difficult. Mm-hmm. And it was very early on in the peace process. But I mean, looking back on it, I'm very pleased that I did find a way. You know, he said he was didn't say this, he said he was disarmed by my empathy. And if I'd gone in there arguing with him, going, I'm right, you're wrong, and telling him he was an evil person, he wouldn't have changed.
I feel like I have years of practice in learning or in knowing how to listen to frame my counter argument. And it is so, so hard to let that go in order to listen to understand. It's such a huge effort to, I can do it in my head, but then when I get into a conversation, it's very hard to remember.
Well, and like sometimes I have argued with him. We once had an argument about Gandhi, and it in the end it made me laugh because we're in this hotel in Belfast, and the hotel that's been bombed the most, and we're sitting there arguing about Gandhi, and I just had to laugh at the end. But I did get into that arguing mode, you know. So that first time, I think I was completely present to him. At other times, you know, I've been less present. It hasn't always been like that.
Thank you.
So, Joe, I have a sort of we're getting a little short on time, but Jana, if you got one that can touch on quickly, and maybe Joe can deal with relatively quickly, go ahead.
I came late, but I'm very familiar with your work, and I've blogged about it. I'm overjoyed to meet you, and we've met on Twitter a little bit. Yeah. What was the last thing you said? I was just going to comment on it.
We argued about Gandhi.
That sometimes we can argue being present. That arguing with someone doesn't necessarily mean that we're not present. It can be from the heart.
But I wasn't. No, I was angry with my arguing. I got into a place of, I'm right, you know, because I was going, Gandhi's my inspiration. He's going, no, Gandhi's my inspiration. I'm going, it can't be, you know. That, I'm right, you're wrong mode. There was no listening going on from my part. You know, just an example of like, you know, I'm not always able to be like that. But when I'm on stage with him, I usually find that I can. It sort of gives me an extra reason to be present to him.
Thanks, Jana. I'm glad you brought that.
Lovely to meet you. Fine. Oh, but I can challenge him with dignity, and that's the other thing, is that can come from the heart. So I have learned how to challenge, and that's sort of different. I see that different from arguing.
So my little question, I think, might lead into the action that you and I talked about, that you can sort of introduce folks to. I heard you say that living with an open heart is sort of a daily work, daily practice in some way, or opening your heart. And then you also talked about this experience or ideal or value of unbounded empathy. It's such a spacious, rich kind of expression. So I'm curious, in that daily work of opening the heart and moving towards that place of unbounded empathy, like, give us a little bit of a clue as to what that daily journey looks like, and what is the landscape of unbounded empathy. Say a little bit about that, if you would. And then if you want to, you can lead right from that into the action that we're going to invite folks to take.
Thank you. Unbounded empathy is being able to see everybody in their full humanity and having an awareness of the times when I don't. So yesterday, I have many examples when I'm not in that space. So yesterday, I was in my little health food shop where I live, and there's only four people allowed, social distancing, everyone's wearing masks, respectful. And someone came in the shop and was not at all respectful and did not wear a mask and went very close to everyone. And was really very aggressive, you know, making a point, and he really upset the woman in the shop who I know well, and I could see she was really distressed. And I looked at him and I felt huge anger, you know, how dare he behave like this? I was judging him, I was blaming him. I wanted to go and shout at him. No, my emotions are quite high at the moment. You know, we're in complete lockdown here. I have a lot of concerns about my daughters in London. We've all got a lot on our plates. So the emotions just came up. And as I was waiting to pay for my food that I was buying, I just thought, okay, what is his story? What is his story? And I looked at him and I looked at his eyes. I could see his whole face because there was nothing covered. So I could look at this whole expressions in his face. And, you know, and I tried to connect with him, but he wouldn't look at me. He was not wanting to connect at all. And I just took some deep breaths and thought, I don't know his story, but he has a story. And I checked the sales system was okay because she was so upset. And then someone came to help her. And so I left the shop and just walked down the road and blessed him and thought, you know, whatever's going on, he's managing his needs the best way he can. And I don't know what's behind that. And that was like just a mini one, but I get them all the time, you know. My first response when I feel pain is still to want to blame someone and make them wrong. Like I'm no way am I at all saying, like, you know, and when it comes to my daughters, anyone who hurts them, I'm really ready to rage. And injustice, all sorts of triggers. So that's daily work. And to me, it's about that curiosity. And that's what I'm going to invite you. Who is it right now that you find hard to listen to? That you find hard to see them in their full humanity? That you want to see them as less than or your other or judge them? Not have that cup of tea, either in person or as a metaphor. You know, who is it that doesn't have as much humanity as you? And just be curious about their story. I think imagination is quite often the only thing that we have. And the moment we get curious, I feel like our hearts just move a little bit, just open a little bit, just even a tiny bit, and that's enough. I'm not suggesting we have to love these people. Just open our hearts, stretch them, just begin stretch. And I think that stretching of our hearts is it's just so important in the healing. And I really believe that even if we can't meet the people, just having that moment of our hearts opening and embracing them can change the world. So that's my offer to you.
Thank you so much, Joe. And just to sort of put my structural underline around some of that, if I can, the invitation for your action, if you'd like an action for the month of January, maybe you just started it just now in the last minute, to hold in your mind this, if there's someone that you are in this place of judgment, blame, separation from, that you know you're unwilling to sit down and have that cup of tea with. The invitation is to engage your curiosity, engage a little bit of curiosity about what is their story. Can you stretch your heart for a moment just to embrace their humanity? And that might be just right here on this call, or maybe you'll take this with you and do some writing, do some thinking, see where it leads. Joe, yeah. Thank you so much. I think it's 3 a.m. where you are, is that right?
Oh, is it? Let me check.
It's 6.
Oh, 2:09.
Oh, 2. Okay, my math's a little bit off, but regardless, I think we
I'm
will
glad
let you...
my math wasn't off.
We didn't keep you even later than you thought. Thank you so much for being with us. And to let you know, in case you didn't know, and to reminder to other folks, this is being recorded and will be saved on our website as a downloadable podcast. So if you want to refer folks to our web page to get a copy, or if you want a recording, let me know, I can send it to you. And other folks, feel free to download it and share it. But thank you so much, Joe. As Nancy mentioned in her comment, I think it was really a perfect conversation for this time for us, for many of us.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank all of you. And so my heart goes with you all. And I know there's a very challenging time and that you're all here for the same reasons I am here, to create peace. And this is a massive challenging day in the next couple of days. So my heart goes with you. And I might just stay a little bit longer, but turn my video off. And then I'll just sort of quietly go to bed. But thank you so much. It's been amazing to connect with you. It was a real honor. So thank you.
Likewise. Okay. So moving right along, next on our agenda is an update from the Department of Peacebuilding Committee. And I believe Kendra Mann is the representative. Last time you spoke, there was a bit of an echo. Let's see where that is now. Oh, you're muted now, so there's no echo at all, but still an issue.
Okay, let's see how it sounds. So far,
great.
So
good? Sounds great.
Okay, the Department of Peacebuilding report. So I have my notes. What we've been doing, what we call far out planning. We have just been operating from action to action to action for a long time. And so we wanted to do like a 3-year plan. And so we have asked people, and Nancy has sent out an e-blast to all of our folks asking for 1 to 2 page proposals that would help us toward enacting a Department of Peacebuilding in the United States. And they're due by January 15th, and you can send them to nancy@peacealliance.org. And already she's gotten, I think it's 17 or more proposals, and they range from all kinds of things. So, you know, it just encourages us to think of what, and think instead of act all the time. The bill we hope will be resubmitted, because it has to be resubmitted every 2 years. And so this is the period of a lot of bills being introduced, of course. And we hope for the same number, HR 1111. And Nancy was meeting fortuitously with Barbara Lee, the author's legislative director, Greg Adam, on the morning of January 5th. As everything broke loose, he listened to all of the suggestions that committee members made about changes to the bill, and at the beginning, at the end of the conversation, after he had heard about what was going on in the Capitol, he said to her that we must not be distracted. We must continue to focus on peace. And we just all thought that was pretty extraordinary under the conditions that he was operating in at that moment. So the next on our calendar, after the bill is dropped, or when, is Season for Nonviolence, which is based around Gandhi and King. And it goes from January 30th to April 4th. It's an international movement to celebrate nonviolence and further nonviolence. So that's a period when we contact our legislators again and talk to them about the importance of this. We're constantly asking people if they would ask their organizations, clubs, churches, if they would be willing to endorse in United States cabinet level Department of Peace Building. And that can also, there's a form also on the website, or they can send to Nancy at peacealliance.org. And I just wanted to say that with Joe in the UK and Nancy and I and Ann Kreter representing the United States on the Global Alliance for Ministries and Infrastructures for Peace, it's just been very heartwarming to see how so many nations and so many people around the world are focusing on peace and peace building right now. Thank you.
Thank you, Kendra. Wonderful. Thank you so much. Thanks to all the folks doing this work. Ann, great to have you with us. Ann Kreter, who's been a board member of the Peace Alliance and has been an active member of the DOP committee as long as there's been one, and my good buddy, lobbying partner in DC. I want to give a little update on the Truth and Reconciliation / Truth and Healing working group. There are several people on this call who have been part of that working group. So anything that you folks want to add in to what I mentioned, feel free. We've got a few minutes. So this working group started to form about 4.5 months ago. We had done some truth and reconciliation focus in the last year and a half with the Peace Alliance. We looked at promoting the Equal Justice Institute's work around the history of Jim Crow and slavery. And we've looked at a few things along those lines sporadically. But then we created this initiative to form a working group and develop some strategy moving forward around truth and reconciliation or truth and healing regarding the U.S. history, primarily regarding the U.S. history of racial violence, the genocide of indigenous people and the murderous practices of slavery and Jim Crow up through the present moment. So this working group formed, it met 8 times in the fall. And there, in 2021, the working group has currently formed 2 subcommittees, sub-focus groups. One is focused primarily on policy, and the other is focused primarily on stories, the gathering, curation, and sharing of relevant stories. In the policy group, to my knowledge, there's so far been focused, actually the policy group itself has not met yet, but regarding policy, in the fall, we talked about the truth and reconciliation aspects available within the Department of Peacebuilding legislation. So the opportunity to advocate for truth and healing through DOP advocacy. There also in the previous Congress were 2 specific bills aimed at truth and reconciliation on the federal level that we thought if another version is entered, we could get behind and we could also potentially influence what the next version looks like. And there also are various state initiatives from the past and the present. Those focus groups, the folks looking at stories have already done some beautiful work in terms of creating a video, a 10-minute video, as sort of an introduction to some concepts around truth and reconciliation. The story group is going to be meeting, I believe it's going to consistently meet now on the first Saturday of each month. And the policy group is going to meet this coming Saturday. And so far, they're slated to meet on the 3rd Saturday of every other month. We'll see if they become monthly or not. And the large group, the full group, is going to continue to meet on the 2nd Saturday of every other month, so the even months, so February, et cetera. If you are excited about this and want to learn more, just email me, dan@peacealliance.org, and I'll spell it out for you and let you know. On the call with us, there are folks who are taking leadership roles on those subgroups. There's Richard and DJ and Jana and Charlie and Nancy and Kendra and Geraldine, the ones that I've noticed. There may be more folks on this call who are participating in that group. Anybody want to chime in with anything you want to add regarding that working group or anything about the project? Yeah, Richard.
I'll just chime in with I'm sending out an email tonight or tomorrow morning inviting people to the meeting with the website and the agenda. And those who know a lot more about it would be, that I know of, Nancy and Jana. But it, that will be going out from the people who kind of signed up.
Thanks, Richard. Glad to hear it. Appreciate it. Now, Richard stepped up to be one of the conveners for the policy group. So he's taken the responsibility of getting that group, that policy subgroup together, which is very important. Anybody else from that group want to chime in? Or at this point, we can also segue into shares or questions from the field. How are we doing for time? We've got 10 minutes. So yeah, Nancy, you want to add something or yeah, whatever's on your mind.
I just wanted to say it's really an awesome group. And if anybody's even mildly interested, to please. And I'm learning a lot. So, and then I wanted to do a share in a minute about the Department of Peace Building congressional co-sponsors, but I can wait until.
Awesome. Yeah, I'd love to get right back to that in a moment. It just occurred to me to remember to mention, probably a lot of people are aware, but another thing that's been happening every Saturday is the Hope Story Circle. So that meets every Saturday at, I think it's noon. Yeah, it's noon Eastern time. And it's a place where they have a sort of an inspirational talk that is an invitation into a conversation. And then people split up into breakout rooms, and it's really a chance to get sort of meditative and reflective and share with folks about inspiring and relevant political, spiritual, personal stuff. The ones I've participated in have been really, really positive and moving, and I think there's a consistent group that's broadly international that's been meeting every Saturday. So I highly recommend that for an experience and resource. Nancy, do you want to say more about that?
Legislation?
Co-sponsor?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I hope we all hold in our hearts and good thoughts the members of Congress, our members of Congress and their staffers. They also have gone through a really traumatic week, including Nancy Pelosi's staff had to hide under her table for 2.5 hours as people were trying to break down the doors. And I don't know if you all saw pictures of Susan Wild, who's from Pennsylvania. She's one of our co-sponsors. There were pictures of her having to take cover in the gallery of the House office of the House chambers. Mm. There was a picture of Andy Kim, who's also a co-sponsor, cleaning up glass and stuff in the building. And then just today we learned that two of our other co-sponsors, Bonnie Watson Coleman from New Jersey and Pramila Jayapal from Washington, got COVID as a result of having to be in close contact and being held in that building for hours and hours without some other members of Congress wearing masks. So just to remember they're human beings, and for the most part, I think trying to do to be righteous people. So.
Thanks, Nance. In the 5 or 6 minutes remaining, I welcome folks. If you want to say more about the Truth and Healing or Truth and Reconciliation Working Group, feel free. If you want to give us some updates about what's happening in your neck of the woods, whatever is happening in your peace building life, in person or virtual, whatever is relevant for you, this is a time for us to hear from each other if there's anything to be shared. And again, you can raise your hand physically, you can use your electronic hand raising. If you're on the phone, *9 is to raise your hand. While we're waiting, I'll be a good little nonprofit person and say the Peace Alliance appreciates everybody's financial contributions. If that's something that you feel inspired to do, feel free to go to the website, whatever works for you. We're happy to have one-time donations, monthly contributions. It all helps, you know, pay for the Zoom account and that kind of thing. So feel free to support in that way. And again, grab that podcast if you wish and share it with whomever. Katrina usually has the recordings on the website within a couple of days. Anybody have anything that they are wanting to share or ask about anything that you've
Dan, this is Geraldine. I do have something that's going on locally in Los Angeles. The city council has a motion going before it to form a feasibility committee to actually establish an office of violence prevention.
Okay.
So these are things that, you know, local, state, federal, it's great working on everything.
Yay, terrific. I thought of an announcement I could make. There, about 2 years ago, was established, or a year and a half ago, a National Center for Restorative Justice. It's a in partnership with Vermont Law School, but they're virtual partners all over the place. So they are working to create an institute on restorative justice and policing this coming summer. I'm lucky to be invited to participate in the kind of preliminary brainstorming working session. There's going to be two full days of conferencing in February. And I've been co-facilitating police youth dialogues monthly with a gap when we first got shut down from COVID, but now we're doing it virtually. Aside from that gap, I've been doing it monthly for about 2 years now. It'll be probably a dozen or two dozen in February at the smaller group. So there'll be lots and lots, I think, of restorative practice facilitators and coordinators and law enforcement coming together over the summer, possibly virtually, we'll see how that goes, to talk about restorative practices and policing. So it's just very promising to me. I'm excited and honored to be a part of it and see where it goes. So if you work with police and restorative practices, or if you know someone who does, you might put a bug in their ear to look on the website for coming events for the National Center for Restorative Justice. Well, I think if we can just have a moment of quiet, let's do Yelena's campfire activity. I'll welcome you to do this. We got it from Yelena, and we sort of taken it over. So historically, so many times when people gather, it's around a campfire. So we're going to try to simulate some of that shared campfire warmth. Okay, if you imagine that we're in a big circle, and first you can start to create the experience of warmth by rubbing your hands together like this, and just do it just fast enough and hard enough that you start to feel the warmth. There it is. It's the fire starting to affect us. Feel it building. And then let's sort of send it to the fire, like we're receiving it and we're also sharing it with each other. So we're sitting around one big campfire, feeling that warmth that we share. And then bring some of that into our own hearts. You can put sort of one hand on your chest and one hand on your abdomen, and just bring some of that shared warmth into ourselves. And then we can open our hands and let some of that warmth shine and radiate towards wherever it's needed, wherever we can feel abundant in sending it, and wherever it's most helpful in this crazy, beautiful, challenged, growing, puzzling, delightful world of ours. With that, I thank you all so much and wish you a beautiful evening. And you're welcome to unmute yourselves. I can unmute everybody. Oh, I can't unmute everybody. For some reason, I don't see that button. But you're welcome to unmute yourselves and say whatever you'd like to say as we take leave of each other.
Thank you, Dan. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.
Dan and everybody, yes, thank you.
Thank you. Good night.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Ta-ta.
Ta-ta, fancy Nancy.
I like Delightful World. I like them.
Right. Right. Good night, all.